You're listening to Donuts and Top Cow.
Two great tastes that taste better together.
Thank you for listening. My name is John Grigas, and our co-host Josh Crawley will be joining us in a second. Thank you for joining us for the 25th episode of Donuts and Top Cow. And we had our first little podcast tragedy, I guess you could say, this week when we recorded about half the show and had to stop and save and ended up bombing out and losing most of that. So instead of starting over again, we're going to pick up with what I was able to recover at least. And we have at least the last, most of the show really, the last 25 minutes. And we walk through the Witchblade Volume 1 trade. What did you miss? Well, we got donuts this week. We had Glazers from Quick Trip, which is a gas store slash convenience store in the upper Midwest. And they have a kind of a Krispy Kreme knockoff glazed donut they call Glazers. And they're not as light and airy as Krispy Kreme, and they're also not kind of as sticky on the fingers as Krispy Kreme. The glaze dries to a more firmer glaze, and pretty good, not bad. Got good reviews. It's a decent alternative. And the other donut news we had is that Dunkin' Donuts had its IPO last week, a successful IPO. They opened up, and their shares went up to $27. And not sure where they're at now, but maybe we'll keep an eye on that. And we both were kind of surprised that Dunkin' Donuts had not been public for all this time, and it had been held by private investment group, and they have over 7,000 stores, so it's kind of interesting. The other thing we did is walk through the San Diego Comic-Con news. We will touch on that in more detail on our next episode, which should be coming up fairly soon. We reviewed the Darkness 2 video game and noted that the distribution date had been moved from November to February 7th. And we also looked at the pilot season 2011, but we didn't look at it in that much detail. We're going to do an episode that walks through the pilot season books that are coming up right around the time they get solicited, or before the first one gets solicited. We'll walk through the lineup of what's coming with some familiar names as creators. And then the biggest news, in my opinion, and I think Josh would agree, the fact that Artifacts is going to stay on as an ongoing series with issue 14. They won't renumber it, but they'll continue with issue 14, and the creative team will be Ron Mars writing still, and Stefan Siach will be moving over to Artifacts after the Witchblade run. So that is pretty good news. We're excited about that. Josh had predicted that this was a non-team-up, team-up book, and I think that makes sense if that is the case. We're still full of some intrigue and not sure how Artifacts is going to end with issue 13. It's safe to say that Sarah is going to survive because Tim Seeley was announced as the ongoing writer of Witchblade, as we noted in our last episode, and she's moving to Chicago. So we're expecting some bad things for Patrick Gleason and some changes for Sarah Pizzini and maybe some more, but we're just not sure on that. So I'll pick up the show from where we were able to recover.
In any case, back to Top Cow.
Yeah, sorry.
Are walking through, as we move through Artifacts, and I guess it feels a little bit less climactic now that Artifacts is going to be ongoing, but one of our ideas was, let's walk through the modern Top Cow universe as we move towards Artifacts 13 and start off with what we recommend people start off with, and that is Witchblade Volume 1 by Ron Mars and Mike Choi, and this collects the Witchblade, starting with Witchblade 80 to 85. So it's basically the modern age Witchblade that we're following. And that first story arc is Witch Hunt. And if you're really into Artifacts and having fun with that, then Ron Mars really kind of gives you a lot to play with issue 80, which is the first chapter of this trade. And depending on how much of a Easter egg type player you want to hunt for, there's some interesting things that you can kind of twist to a more fun meaning in that book.
Yeah, it's weird going back to I think this is probably my fourth time reading this. And even just within the trade, there are evolutions of things that I find interesting.
Yeah, these are really, it's really a pivotal book because the where the Witchblade has gone really got its seed in that issue 80. It's where we see the first real rendition of Sarah in practically full body armor as the Witchblade through this trade.
It's not shredding her clothes.
It's not shredding her clothes. It's covering things that you would think you'd want to protect if you were battling fire-breathing demons and things. So,
like boobies.
That's that's meaningful. And then a couple of key characters are introduced here. This is where Ron introduces very pivotal characters to the series, and the first one is Patrick Gleason.
Yeah, there's some interesting Patrick Gleason stuff in here that I believe has pretty much been, retconned.
Patrick Gleason is, as you know from reading The Witchblade, Patrick Gleason is Sarah's partner on the force and also partner at home. And in this, he first encounters her after she defeats a demon and she is rendered into a coma and in the hospital. And Gleason is assigned to investigate this special case. And he interrogates Jake, who is her former partner, who is sitting with her in the hospital, and he interacts with her. Now, one thing we're not going to do is we're not going to walk through the Witchblade story that makes up this trade, but we are going to look for little nuggets that show the foundation pieces that built us to where we are today. So Gleason introduces himself as a 39-year-old on the job for 17 years, the last three attached to the commissioner's office, and I come from a cop family. So what do you take from the Gleason introduction in the book, Josh?
Gleason is never really drawn as looking 39 after maybe the first panel he's introduced in. Also, reading his little secret origin in issue 144, he's from a family of Irish firefighters, not a cop family. And issue 144 is just the first place where we could easily find, I guess, proof, but I swear it has been mentioned before 144, but after issue 80, that he's from a family of firefighters, because for some reason I have it in my head that his family wasn't happy with that decision.
Yeah, created some conflict there.
Yeah.
And so Ron introduces him as being from a long line of cop family, and I my memory is kind of shaky, but it seems like that's come up again throughout the Ron Mars run on Witchblade, at least once or twice more. And maybe it's something to note that Gleason short in Witchblade 144 wasn't written by Ron.
True, but things have gotten pretty cohesive lately.
That's true.
And honestly, when it comes to Gleason being drawn as 39, it's not like Sarah's being drawn as looking any older than she was 15 years ago either. So
that's true.
I can't complain too much, but it just...
But we look a lot younger these days than they did years ago.
It's all the preservatives.
I look just like Gleason, and I'm 45, so...
I don't remember who it was, actually, but when we had the Michael Morisi signing, someone was amazed that you were 45. Because you totally didn't look it. I'm like, yeah, of course I couldn't remember how old you were either. I don't even think about it at this point.
Well, it helps that you act like you're 12 half the time and you act like you're 22 the other half of the time.
Yeah.
That's the secret I'm sharing with everybody. That's how to try to stay young. So Gleason is introduced as kind of a, you know, hard-nosed investigative cop, but not a necessarily unlikable one. And it's not a question of whether he's a good guy or a bad guy the way he's portrayed here. But he does factor in. He is the first character to interact with another new character that Ron introduces in this, and he introduces himself as the curator. Or actually, he says, "Call me a curator." And our first, he glances in at Sarah at the hospital. Gleason spots him, and then he disappears, which, you know, is kind of a common theme where he can come and go. And Gleason follows him down and ends up in his shop. And the curator is very glad to see him. Actually, I don't know, glad is the right word. He expects to see him. He knows that this is rolling along. And there's a couple of interesting nuggets that may foretell the future. So when Gleason first interacts with the curator, it's in the curator's shop. And what's interesting is He says, tell me what happened to her in the church. And he said, the past is past. Better you ask what will happen. Better you ask what Sarah Pizzini is. And then he goes through...
You know what? Before we go any further.
Yeah.
Not to completely... Whoosh,
go ahead.
That kind of... It reminds me of kind of the way Ron has, I think, approached a lot of his run on the Witchblade at times, which is every so often there's kind of a better than normal jumping on point that involves using characters other than Sarah Pizzini to move the story along, introduce things. Like in this point, you know, I mean, you pick up the book and the title character is in a coma. And we get a new character to introduce this stuff to someone who is possibly a new reader. But then we also get another new character to get even more information instead of just the same three people that longtime readers might know already. So this way it's kind of, you know, even longtime readers get something new. But then Ron's built them up over all this time, but...
So it's not six pages of exposition instead and retelling of an origin story.
Yeah, I mean,
story.
At least we get... Or even if it is, in a sense, giving information longtime readers already have, it's getting it from a different perspective by way of a new character.
Well, and that's a great perspective.
That doesn't seem,
I like that
thought. It doesn't seem forced.
No, not at all. And what's I guess, good about it is that long-term readers can... dig into their own questions of, well, why are these guys here and what are they supposed to do? That's a great point about jumping on point, especially, and it's pretty useful since that's what we recommend as a jumping on point is this trade. So that really works. And I don't think that's inconsistent with where we were going. There are a couple foretelling things that the curator says that do apply to the storyline that's in this book. You know, Witchblade Volume 1 is a well-contained story, but it can foretell of greater things that can be built around it. But one of the things that the curator talks about is he says that it will fall to Sarah to harness all that the Witchblade is, to bend its nature to her will. If she fails in this, the world will end in blood and fire. Which, while it does relate to the end of this trade in a way, maybe overtly, it's fun to imagine that we're moving towards artifacts as early as issue 80. And then Gleason basically throws that out as a load of crap, and he responds, "What reason is there to lie to you? Believe these things, accept the truth of it, because it will fall to you to help her spare this world. A beast is coming."
Oh yeah, it's going to fall to him to help, to sacrifice himself or be sacrificed in artifacts.
See, as early as 80, we're seeing those signs, the things we've been talking about all along. You just start lighting your candles for Patrick Gleason.
Yep.
So later in the story, they run into the curator again, and this time Sarah also meets the curator, and they have just as cryptic an interchange, although a small token is handed over, just a little idol is handed over from the curator to Gleason and says, "You'll know what to do with this when the time comes."
Oh, yeah. You've jumped ahead quite a bit here.
A lot. Well, like I said, we're not really walking through the story.
Oh,
no. Looking for some clues.
There are a couple things I'm going to touch on, though, one of which is clue-related. Because, as some people may recall, the book Ron Mars really wanted to write was Magdalena. She shows up, what, in issue 82 already? Like, Ron just couldn't not write her into the story?
Yeah, she shows up in Sarah's apartment.
Not that it feels forced or anything, so I'm not going, oh, he threw her in the first opportunity he had, no matter what. I just, in hindsight, it's kind of funny that he found a way to get her into the story that quickly.
It is pretty clever, because the basic theme of the story is... there is a sect of Catholic priests and monsignors that have been working for years and years collecting and praying and setting up for this, basically praying to the devil in a lot of ways, to pull this demon up from below.
An elder god.
Some elder god to take over the world and then put the monsignor in its place, as that's his reward, that he can rule the earth, you know, under this demon. So and what's kind of funny is that the Magdalena is being used because it's the Catholic Church And these leaders of the Catholic Church here in the diocese in America are using the Magdalena to call Sarah off. Yeah. And so it's kind of funny because, you know, and the Magdalena is pure of heart and serves the, you know, the so-called mission and purpose of the church. And yet here they're using her as a tool as they prepare their evil to come to the world. They're trying to use Magdalena to stop the Witchblade.
And that appears to be issue 82, Witch Hunt Part 3. Think I haven't actually flipped all the way through. Yeah, though, and like what, 3 pages, 4 pages after she shows up, and all of a sudden the Witchblade is interacting rather interestingly with the Spear of Destiny. I don't recall the Spear of Destiny. Of course, I don't know that any other artifacts have ever touched the Spear of Destiny, but and it doesn't look like Sarah's the one being hurt by what could be the glow of the spear.
That's true. As the Magdalene has recoiled.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, artifacts. And another thing I find interesting about this volume, and I actually kind of noticed it as I was reading through again. I don't know if I've noticed it prior. The beginning of this storyline is not lettered by Troy Pateri. By the end of this storyline, Troy Pateri's lettering, and I'm pretty sure he has lettered every single issue since, which is awesome.
Yeah, he's been really great, and the letters have been, it's been a big part of the consistency in the Top Cow universe, because really Troy seems to be doing all of the TCU books.
Yeah. Another interesting thing, just seeing the evolution throughout this volume, is there's a few inkers on the book over Mike Choi's pencils. Sal Regla, Joe Weems, and Matt Banning, also known as Bat, with two T's. I haven't checked the individual issues to see who's inking what. I'm guessing that about halfway through, Sal Regla is the one doing the majority of the inking, because it looks more like the Mike Choi that we've seen since these issues have come out in his later work. And Sal seems to be one of those inkers that doesn't impart as much of... He doesn't have kind of what some people might call that Top Cow kind of scratchy almost style that the first few issues in this trade have.
Yeah.
Also the colors. The first issue, the palette's a little... It's a little yellow. It's still a little yellow as the issues go on, but it seems to be getting more to that palette and style of coloring that Sonia Obak started using once she started coloring Mike Choi, which has been, I think, around end of Volume 2, beginning of Volume 3, which is kind of the early 90s issue numbers, not years, obviously. And they've pretty much been together working since. But it's interesting to see the evolution of even just those few people, even.
Yeah.
Or, I guess, well, more the evolution of Mike Choi's stuff, but the other evolution in palettes and stuff in just one volume of a book because of, I want to say because of that new direction, but it's a really interesting and almost seems like a very quick, this is what the title was, this is what the title is now.
And the evolution of the whole team, really, I think. And, you know, as the character in the story gets depth and evolves, I think Ron Marz's writing of these characters also evolves. I know he's been an established comic writer for many years before he even wrote his first Witchblade book. But even so, the work that he's doing on Witchblade now and Artifacts is so much richer than even the work in this 80 through 85. But 80 through 85 is a great storyline. It's a good contained story. If you're not familiar with the Witchblade, this is a good way to understand what she's up against and her power. And there's also some good religious commentary and behavior that comes into play that has been a theme of some of Ron's best work with Top Cow, as you brought up with the Magdalena. So it still can be found at your local retailer for a pretty attractive price of $4.99 for that first trade. So if you don't have it or haven't read it for a while, pick it up, because it'll be worthwhile for you. And if you're reading Artifacts, it'll be a lot of fun because there will be some characters that you know real well and you can get to know them a little better in a different way and how they were first introduced to Witchblade readers.
And I just randomly thought of this actually earlier, but if for some reason Ron needed to do like a stock story. Anyways, whatever. Basically, if Ron needed to write a fill-in for another artist to do so they just have something on file, I wouldn't mind an issue or two maybe dealing with parts of this story from the Witchblade's perspective. Or the Witchblade's. I wouldn't mind parts of this story from the Magdalena's perspective.
Yeah.
Just kind of maybe what she was doing before and after. Just to kind of, you know, see the other side of the fence. Maybe even bring Michael, you know, get Michael Choi to do another issue.
That'd be a fun issue or two.
I don't know if he's exclusive to anyone. But it'd be a fun little fill-in if, you know, you just needed an interlude or...
Yeah, because at the time we see the Magdalena here, she is pretty much split off from the church leadership on philosophical terms. So they have a kind of an adversarial relationship if you've been following some of her other books. And so that little gap in between would be interesting. Like, how did she agree to come and confront the Witchblade on their
behalf? Well, I don't
know
if she was really that estranged from them at that point. That's a tough one. I need to reread a bunch of the Magdalena origin stuff.
Yeah, I just...
When
Sarah said, what's the Catholic Church's version of the Terminator want to speak with me about? And she replies, I've parted ways with the church, but I'm still known to certain people within it. So, And then it puts you over to Tomb Raider 47 to see the details of her split with the church.
Wait, how did I miss that? I don't know if my volume has that.
Oh, maybe not. I've got the old Witchblade Volume 10, and I don't really have the Volume 1 edition.
Oh, wait. Oh, that's not in mine. That was taken out of here.
Oh, interesting.
Ooh.
So that's kind of a difference. I'm reading the Volume 10 as the Witchblade trades were first put out. Josh has the Witchblade Volume 1 that was reissued with the new lining of numbering. And on mine, there's an asterisk when she talks about how she was parted with the church, and there's an editor's note about how Maggie left the church in Tomb Raider 47, refusing to follow orders.
Huh. My guess would be part of that was to streamline this book, because obviously I've never needed it any time I've read it. I need to go find me a Tomb Raider 46 now, apparently, though.
And I'm interested
which
in reading
tells
Tomb
me
Raider.
I
didn't know Magdalena was showing up in the Tomb Raider books.
Yeah. Well, there have been Tomb Raider Witchblade crossovers, too.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Oh, learn something new every day. Man, maybe we don't need as much a what was going on. But I still want that Ron Mars penned Magdalena fill-in by Mike Choi.
I'm in. I think it'd be worthwhile. It'd be fun. It'd be a fun book to see. Especially as we continue to see this Witchblade volume in print, it would definitely get an audience. So a lot of fun. I hope that you also have learned some stuff today. That's what kind of the fun of this podcast is about, as we walk through and talk through things. And we'd like to learn from you. So if you have any thoughts, if you have any nuggets, if you have any Easter eggs or just things that we missed, please let us know. You can email us at dtcpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter. We have one for the podcast, which is at DTC Podcast, or our individuals at Josh Crawley, C-R-A-W-L-E-Y, and I'm at J.G. Madison W. And we interact a lot. Also, catch our Facebook page. You can like us. Just find us. We're Donuts and Top Cow, and Donuts is spelled D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T-S.
Yeah, so there.
So as I promised or warned, as some may be, I am involved in a fundraiser for Give Kids the World Village, which houses families with children with terminal illnesses who have a wish to go to Walt Disney World. They turn no family away, even if they're not going through Make-A-Wish Foundation. They turn no family away, and that family gets a week of distraction, just a week of really enjoying life instead of wondering what's going to happen at the next doctor's appointment and what the countdown ticker looks like, but instead gets to just appreciate the beauty of a day, whatever that day happens to hold. There's a group that is trying to raise $1 million, and the main push is through a program called Power of 10, and the call came out. They're looking for people who can get 10 friends to give $10 to Give Kids the World. And I'm not specifically asking anybody listening to help me with that, but it would be great if you could.
You're not, but I am.
Yeah, and I feel okay because I have found 10 friends to do that when the campaign first started in January, but I guess I want to kind of double dip and go back to the well. So I will say, if you're willing to, please tweet one of us and we'll give you the details. If you can come up with $10 for these kids, that would be great. And I personally will match the first 10 people that will come up and give 10. So if I can get 10 people to give $10 each, then I'll also give $100. And that means that you have doubled your gift. The other thing we're doing is a fundraiser here at Westfield Comics in Madison. And we're giving you about a few weeks to get here because, you know, airline tickets are pretty cheap 21 days out. You know, that's when you find the good flight. So get to Madison. Come see us. But on the 18th of August, that's a Thursday, we are doing a program called Ice Cream for Breakfast. So for $5, come and have an ice cream sundae, and all of the money go to Give Kids the World. You can also come and see Josh's store and interact with us, and we'll have some fun entertainment and other things going on.
I'll sign you.
Ooh.
Did you see that Power Girl from San Diego that got her boob signed by Adam Hughes?
Ah, nice.
Awesome.
I didn't see that, but I'm going to go to Google after we get off of this here. So if you want to get signed by Josh, come on down. And he takes all comers, so don't think that, you know, don't think you have to be Power Girl in order to get signed.
Nope.
But it would be fine. I think that if I was going to say, you know, Aphrodite 9 might work, or Aphrodite 4, if you were going to come cosplay in that, I guarantee you Josh will sign you.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening. Have a great week.
Good journey.